Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. This week, our guest is the author of How to Win the Information War, Johns Hopkins Fellow and Expert on Propaganda, Peter Pomerantsev. Now remember, we love taking your questions, so write into politicswarroom@gmail.com or send a tweet to @Politicon for next week's show. We'll get to as many as we can, but don't forget to tell us where you're from. Please check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Miracle Made, and ExpressVPN in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting these sponsors. It really helps make this podcast happen. Please tell your friends about us and remind them to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. James, I'm going to do something unusual. I think it has relevance. I'm going to start with just a teeny bit of history. 50 years ago, Richard Nixon and the Republican Party, when he clearly had committed impeachable offenses, probably crimes, Barry Goldwater, Howard Baker, and other Republicans went and said, it's time to go. We need to turn the page. Richard Nixon's offenses were a Tea Party compared to Donald Trump's criminality. Yet almost every Republican, after he was adjudicated guilty by a jury of 12 citizens, everyone guilty, 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 his attorney did not object to those participants. Now every one of the Republicans, with only one or two exceptions, is rallying behind their felon leader. And they're saying our judicial system is corrupt, including the jury. You know, these people are lying, which I guess is not a surprise. It's insulting. They're charging things like Joe Biden, who orchestrated the Manhattan grand jury. James, you remember these are the people who used to talk about separation of powers and federalism. Now it's whatever the political godfather instructs them to do. I'm not sure how this is going to play out. I saw a couple polls. One, ABC, has said that a majority of independents and double haters, people who hate both candidates, want Trump to drop out. But as my great pollsters Bob Teeter and Peter Hart at the Wall Street Journal used to say, wait a couple weeks and then measure it. So I'm not sure how it plays out politically, but it told us everything we need to know about the disgraceful state of most of the Republican Party.
Well, as you know, I don't think the Republican Party exists. I mean, it's a personality cult. And you could go chapter and verse of all of the, you know, the evangelicals embracing Trump. But it's not going to change.
That's not. And
look at Chris Sununu. I mean, Larry Hogan had the timidity to say whatever the verdict is, we should respect that before the verdict. And they went crazy. And he's not going to win a Senate seat that was winnable because all of the Trump people had turned on for just saying we should respect the jury. So I can't tell you I'm overly nostalgic for what the Republican Party, that we don't have a Republican Party, but that's what their voters want. And, you know, as long as you got people saying stupid shit out there, like the judge should have recused himself because of a $35 contribution that he asked the supervisory jurisdiction, and they said, no, there's no need to do that. And, you know, you got people saying, you know, supposedly smart people saying, well, if the average person did this, it'd never be prosecuted. It's just all bullshit. And the Constitution's at threat, and the country has to act like it.
Yeah, I do. James, I used to think people exaggerated when they said the outcome of an election is really existential for America. I mean, I didn't vote for Ronald Reagan in 1980. I think he did some bad things, but it didn't threaten the fabric of what America is all about. And I'm sure if you're a right-winger, you didn't vote for Clinton and Obama, you might not like some of the results. This is different. This is far different. What Donald Trump would do to America is something that is existential. And you know what? All those Republicans just say, you know, how far do you want to go? I mean, it's reminiscent of some awfully bad times in history.
Well, you know, he's telling you what he's going to do. And I got to say, if he runs and he wins, he can justifiably say, I told you I was going to do this. This is what you voted for, so I have a mandate to do it. I mean, that's literally, he's not even being duplicitous about it.
No, he's not. It's one area he's not being duplicitous. You're right.
Right. And he's telling you what, he's not going to pay attention to anything. He's going to get rid of all the civil servants. He's going to put all of his own people. He's not going to fool around with the Jeff Sessions or Rex Tillersons of the world, or Tom Price's, but my God, they're not partisan enough. And you're going to see clowns. What he's going to do, there's going to be no more NATO. We're going to be right in bed with Russia in every way that you possibly can think. It's catastrophic. That's all I can say. To lose this thing would be catastrophic to the country.
Yeah, it really would be. James, there were a couple primaries this week, not big ones, not terribly revealing. Trump's candidate for in New Jersey for the Senate lost to an establishment candidate. And in a number of states, again, you saw that both, 16-17% of voters in Democratic primaries don't vote for Joe Biden, who is uncontested, and the same number in Republican primaries don't vote for Donald Trump. I mean, I cannot think of a time that was even close where you had two candidates where so many Americans don't want either one.
Well, the real granular evidence for this is in the polling and contested Senate races. Well, sometimes there's a 12-point differential between the Democratic senator's vote and Biden's vote. And it's just undeniable. Two things are undeniable. The country does not like this choice, but it's the most consequential choice maybe we've ever made in American politics, certainly in a long time. So, it's not going to end up a 12-point differential on Election Day, but to me, that's the most significant political news of the summer of 2024.
Yeah, it really is. Again, you've talked about this a lot, but it's absolutely true. You look at state after state. I mean, I'm exaggerating. 6-7 states: Nevada, Montana, Ohio, Pennsylvania, Arizona. It is remarkable how well the Democratic Senate candidates, most of them in those states, incumbents, are running vis-a-vis Joe Biden. There is a really considerable gap. How do you explain that?
I think that we have good candidates. Our incumbents are at risk, but they're good. I think they made a flaw that they thought we'll get all these self-funded people.
And the Republicans
we'll save money
did.
And bid Republicans yet.
Yeah.
And you know, I think it was Balzac or somebody said, behind every great fortune, there's a crime. Mm-hmm. And these guys in Pennsylvania, in Wisconsin, in Montana, they're all getting exposed. And my only kind of macro prediction about the election, I like to predict things, I think we do better in North Carolina than Nevada. But I hope we can win North Carolina, but we'll be close.
Well, there was just the Democratic candidate put out an ad about Mark Robinson, the Republican candidate, in which he said, and I'm almost quoting verbatim, Mark Robinson said in opposing any abortions that he's not going to give mothers who kill children a break because they aren't responsible enough to keep their skirts down. Wow. I think that's a race that's going to end. It may not be double digits. It's a state that's just too purple, even a little bit red. But that's not going to be a close race at the end.
I agree. And, hopefully, I don't think your observation is possible to be negative coattails. In other words, the governor's race could have some effect in the presidential race in a positive way for Democrats, I think is a legitimate observation. I can't tell you if it's true or not, but it's certainly legitimate. It could be true.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think it could be true in Arizona, too.
I feel better about Arizona and Georgia.
Well, you got a strong Senate candidate, and you got abortion on the ballot. And I think those are the only two things that could lift up Joe Biden to winning an narrow victory.
Right. Yes, but we got to catch some breaks here.
Yeah.
We're not going to get down on home.
James, anything else on your mind?
Well, another thing is the Pramila Jayapal, the uber progressive congresswoman from Seattle, her sister ran in a primary in Oregon as uber progressive Democrat, and she didn't do very well. And, I think the Democratic Party, they never were big into this uber progressive stuff. I think the average Democrats start to see that not only is this not a very good policy, it's horrible politics.
Absolutely.
So that's encouraging. And we're going to need that on places like Long Island that you're familiar with. We're going to need that in some of these districts trying to take back in California and other places. Mm-hmm. So every day the evidence comes in that no one really likes these people, and they're going to beat a couple of them in the primaries, too.
Yeah, yeah, watch New York.
Yeah.
Okay.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, James, our guest is a returning guest, Peter Pomerantsev, scholar at Johns Hopkins, expert on propaganda and disinformation. Peter, you got a new book, How to Win the Information War, based largely on the British propaganda expert, Sefton Delmar, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, in World War II, who rather than simply sending messages to the Germans about how bad the Nazis were, tried to subvert Goebbels' propaganda, planning stories about the high command's luxurious lifestyle and sexual pleasures, and also on the way to dessert. Describe what Delmar's philosophy was, and did it really work?
So Delmar kind of despaired of this idea that you could preach about the virtues of democracy to people who were enthralled by Hitler, but generally by any kind of authoritarian propaganda. And he was like, it's too late. By the time they're in love with these leaders, you can't give them lectures about how wonderful democracy is. You've got to disrupt their relationship with the leadership. And he had a really deep understanding of kind of the bonds between the followers of these leaders and the rest of the community that they're in. So his idea was to kind of crawl inside and explode that relationship. He believed in using very, very strong emotion. So his news and radio channels, he created radio channels, basically, were full of pornography and tabloid anger and fury, but directed against Nazi officials. He wouldn't touch Hitler at the start of the war. Hitler was too popular. He'd go, he'd attack mid-level Nazi officials. He knew incredible details about their corruption, about their
He'd been a reporter there, hadn't he? In the 20s,
he'd been not just a reporter. He was probably the most famous foreign reporter there, and he managed to persuade the Nazis that they should trust him, and they let. He accompanied Hitler on his propaganda tours, on his famous airplane tours in the 1920s. So he saw close up how Germans were enjoying the performing, the kind of the euphoria of the rallies, you know, how much they, you know, enjoyed playing the role of Nazis. So he wanted to kind of pollute that that relationship, make it feel foul and disgusting. So that was his philosophy. His philosophy was like, you've got to crawl in and really disrupt that relationship from the inside. Because until you stop, you know, until you start really understanding the pleasures that people derive from being parts of these movements, until you understand how people are enjoying playing these roles that authoritarian propaganda gives you, you're not going to get very far. Look, he set up, just to be clear, he set up at the start of the war these kind of like essentially fake news radio stations. You know, they were pretended mm-hmm. to be Nazi stations, sort of like staffed by far-right soldiers who are even more kind of right-wing than Hitler, saying everybody around Hitler is a communist, everybody there is a pervert, they're all like, you know, they're all letting us down, they should bomb England more than they do now, they're all weak. Very, very cabaret-like. A lot of the people playing these roles were German Jewish exiles from the cabaret scene in Berlin, who were in England. But actually, those early radio stations, those are among his more famous ones. And they still read like incredibly funny, cabaret-like performances. They were caught pretty fast. And as Delmer expanded, and by the end of the war, he was running dozens of stations. He was the head of special operations for Britain's propaganda arm. He was actually doing something much more clever. His stations still would say that they were German stations. They would sound like Nazi stations, but he wanted the audience to understand they were actually British. And the idea was that, like, to give people a safe space to listen to criticism of the Nazis, but also a psychologically safe space. He worked out that if you criticized the German regime from us Germans are being harmed by the Nazis, then people found it much more comfortable to listen to rather than being poked at and saying, you Germans need to listen to us. But also the fact that the English could imitate Nazi radio kind of subverted the very idea that Nazi radio is unique. You're kind of imitating it and they're saying, hey, it's nothing special. You know, we can imitate it, we can exaggerate it. You know, this magical performance is actually, you know, not that unique.
Peter, if Delmar were here today, talk about what he might do differently as far as messaging the Russians, where economic sanctions haven't affected Putin's palace guard and military, but are taking a toll on average citizens. How can you replicate what he did to the Nazis?
So imagine tomorrow morning, Russian soldiers from Syria through to Ukraine and in every place where mobilization is happening in Russia start having like a flood of multimedia, because you'd be multimedia these days, you know, of a radio or a media that's, you know, sounds just like a Russian state media, but clearly isn't, because it's giving you all the dirt, not about Putin, everyone knows Putin's corrupt, he's too far away, but about your immediate officer, about your immediate boss, yeah, all the dirty stuff about them, showing how they're giving you terrible food, how they're stealing the money that's being meant to be sent to your relatives, they're putting in their own pockets, which would give a sense of, you know, the system is vulnerable. You've got to understand, Russians are cynical. They know perfectly well everyone's corrupt. But for somebody to go and say it and name it means these people are vulnerable and their aura of untouchability goes.
Yeah.
But that media wouldn't just be aimed at ordinary soldiers. You know, all ordinary soldiers could do would start looking, you know, at their superiors going, hey, somebody's after you, you're not so strong. But it would start causing chaos within the Russian system, because the boss of the boss would start going, hold on, how come all this stuff is coming out? Who's leaking it? Which is exactly what happened in Nazi Germany with Delmer's programs. They were so well researched that the Nazis were constantly looking as to who was leaking the information when they were just well researched. And so you're getting the, you know, regime to fight amongst itself. Most of all, you're sending a signal right to the top of the system that you're not in control. So the Russian system doesn't care about public opinion the way we do. They don't have elections, but they care about the sense that they're in control. What they're scared of is losing control. So every time you say you're losing control, you're not controlling the information flows. You're not controlling what's happening on the front. You're not controlling what's happening in satellite countries. the elite in Russia start recalculating. They're going, okay, we're losing control, therefore we have to take less risks, therefore let's, for example, not be so belligerent in our war aims. You've got to understand the Russian system is a different system to ours. You guys know this better than anyone else. Effective communication operation depends on understanding that information environment. So only one part of any type of campaign like this would be about changing public opinion. It's just as much about changing elite opinion, which it always was with Dellenberg as well. You know, he wanted the Nazi elites to be freaking out about how much the English knew.
You're a native of Ukraine, and a year ago you were on this podcast, and while acknowledging you were on the edge, you were still pretty optimistic about the war and that Pete and Putin had made a terrible miscalculation. Boy, I hope that was right. I worry today that the reports that the Russians are on the offensive, Ukraine is struggling. Is this reversible, Peter, do you think?
Well, look, it very much depends on us. What I worry about really, and what really never happened was, we're still framing this war as a war about supporting Ukraine. Ukrainians are doing the best they can. I mean, one can criticize many things, but, you know, they're very much in a David versus Goliath situation. This is our war. You know, Russia, China, Iran are coordinating economic warfare, information warfare, physical warfare, with the common aim of, you know, knocking America off its perch. That's what unites them, hatred of America and wanting to show the world that America is incompetent and, in a sense, politically incontinent, dare I say. And there, while some elites in Washington get this, I don't think there's been an all-round understanding of what this is really about. Part of it is about crushing Ukraine, and always has been. Russia thinks Ukraine is its colony and therefore deserves to be under its thumb. The Ukrainians will always fight. But we're still very slow to realize that this is about us. And as long as we're framing this about what can Ukraine do, yes, then Russia might win. As long as we're not saying this is our war, then there's a chance that they can win. And at the moment, they certainly feel that the world will soon be inherited by them and China. And America's done. I mean, you know what they call Trump in Moscow, yeah?
What?
Gorbachev, in a bad way, as in he'll lead to the destruction of America, the way Gorbachev led to the destruction of the Soviet Union. That's one from Mikhail Zigar. That's not my insight. The great Russian exile journalist told me that. But they think we're seeing the last gasps of America. This is what this has always been about.
James Carville, pick up on this.
They might be wrong, by the way. I very much hope they're wrong. Dare I say, that's not my opinion. That's how they see the world.
So thank you. When you were on last, and I've been on this with Admiral Stavridis, that our failure to really engage in a propaganda war, and Putin has a simple strategy. He's just going to wear us down, all right? And eventually the United States and even some countries say, well, there's not anything we can do about it. We've sunk it all kind of money in there, and it's kind of gone nowhere. And I think we should have had a propaganda campaign along with our military aid to convince people what we faced with and why this is important to them. But right now, I just don't see that happening.
You mean domestically in America or into Russia?
And yeah, U.S. and Western Europe, we should have had a propaganda. You know, we should have started early telling people why this is important and telling stories about these Russian soldiers raping women and occupying villages and burning churches down. Anything you do in a propaganda war, I think we should have engaged in one. And we didn't.
No, we left it to the media, and for a while the media did a great job, but the media gets unfocused. You know, they get onto the next story.
You got the election, and you got all kinds of things to distract you. And I think that's what Putin's counting on.
And of course, Putin is doing one here. I mean, it's been the last few months I spent working with various NGOs here and in Ukraine, sort of, because I do a bit of war crimes, well, quite a lot of war crimes research, giving them evidence about the suppression of evangelicals in the occupied territories. And most Americans didn't know about this. So Putin wages a very active propaganda campaign in America for many years, claiming that Russia, where nobody goes to church and is a very hedonistic country, is actually a bastion of Christianity. And Ukraine is the opposite. And actually, the opposite is true. Like, there's huge religious pluralism in Ukraine, actually Protestantism is very, very popular there. It spread like wildfire in the 1990s. And in the occupied regions of Ukraine, the Russians torture and kill evangelical Christians because they see them as American spies. I mean, this is what we would find. They'd arrest them, say, hey, you're an evangelical. That's an American religion. You must be a spy. And murdering them. And nobody knew about that here. And American evangelicals didn't know about that here. And it was basically little NGOs and civil society organizations that had to go to these very influential communities here and engage them, including right to the Speaker of the House. And, you know, thank God they did that, but you can't leave it to little, you know, to little NGOs and individuals just to do that. That has to be done in a sustained and organized way.
So for a turnover, there's a Ukrainian guy, Ruben Rupchenko, and I will try to get you Ruben's contact information. He's famous for a couple of things. First of all, he was a basketball player at LSU, but it was okay, but he got Shaquille O'Neal scholarship. All right? And then, of course, he went to Harvard and got a PhD in physics, like all these people from Ukraine do. The smartest fucking people in the world. And he was over here, and he's very effective in, like, telling the Ukrainian story. And we need more Rubens out there communicating, I think.
So yeah, no, I've read about Ruben. I don't know him personally, though.
Right. But he's somebody that y'all should hook up because he's definitely similarly motivated as you are.
There's a lot of great people. And look, I suppose when we'll look back and analyze what's been going on is the role of civil society to do a lot of the communications activities that used to be always done by the state.
Right.
And that's great. I mean, and Ukrainians are really good at that. The question is sustainability and focus. And, you know, there's only so big a megaphone even a Ruben can have. And you're quite right. You know,
But my point is there's 25 Rubens in Ukraine right now that have an interesting story, an interesting connection here. And, you know, we need storytelling, man. We need storytelling. That's my thing.
So we definitely need storytelling about Ukraine. But I still think that's only part of it. That does get Americans motivated, but it's also about America and, like, what is America's role in the world? And telling stories about how isolationism won't lead to a happy place, because that, you know, that instinct is strong, and I understand that instinct in America. It's an old one. And why America facing up to, you know, this, you know, axis of evil, whatever you want to call it, you know, the four horsemen of China, Russia, Iran, and North Korea, why standing up to them is good for America and is important and why the world needs America so much. That's a story that I don't think a Ukrainian can tell you. I think that's something that Americans have to start telling themselves. Because really this is about, you know, this is also about your identity crisis. You know, we're on the front lines of this in Ukraine, but make no mistake, China, Russia, and Iran are looking at America. You know, Ukraine is obviously a target, but it's America they want to hurt and hobble and render meaningless. And America has to decide, is it going to face up to the challenge or run away?
Well, thank you so much. I'll turn it back to Al, but your points are really well taken, and I hope you continue your scholarship and your affinity for this, because it's going to be critically important as we go forward. So best to you and best to the United States and best to Ukraine.
Yeah, let me just try one more, James. Peter, you are such an expert on getting out information and going after bad people. What would be your message on Donald Trump, who really is a threat to us, to the free world, if you will?
What would be my message on Donald Trump? I mean, I've only been in America a couple of years, and I'm very focused on the international scene, obviously. But it does surprise me that there's been no effort in America to, given the threats, to sort of, well, to essentially make a really clear distinction between the hard MAGA lot, which I think are very hard to penetrate now, and the very many other people who vote for Trump, like, frankly, vote Republican, like most of my relatives here. And you know, I've seen lots of data because I'm looking at sociological research all the time, and there's a clear split. And there's only so much the Democrats can do. They can probably peel off some of them, but they're still going to be Democrats for them. And what you really need is a large social movement that appeals to the values of those people. I mean, the elections in Poland and Brazil were won by the non-authoritarians because there were movements outside of the party, movements appealing to women's rights, to people who value the truth, to foreign policy, and appealed to this much larger electorate without making it party political. You know, if it's just, I mean, there's only so many Republicans Biden can ever reach for obvious reasons. But if you make it about more than that, then you really need civic movements, a new type of media, social movements that engage those audiences, who will then vote whichever way they feel right, but will understand that there's more at stake than just party allegiances. That's what's worked in countering populists in other countries as well. And I'm sort of surprised that hasn't happened. A movement around the health system, a movement around women's rights. There's a little bit of that, but not as much as I thought. A movement around defending electoral integrity and just election officials. I mean, election officials are kind of, usually Republican election officials are kind of the new heroes for me in America, who are, you know, despite their party loyalties, you know, want to uphold the truth that American elections aren't rigged and the last election was not rigged. So there are all these, you know, very, very emotive, very human causes with very real faces to them, which can be very potent social movements. And I think that's the way of undercutting populists like Trump.
James, you want to
tell one more final thing. I understand that they use mockery and porn in this propaganda campaign. You know, I think porn is a good propaganda device. Just give us a short recap of that.
Sure. So look, you got to imagine, this is back to the Second World War. This is not about Trump. I know it's hard with the porn, it gets confusing.
Right. You might apply, but go ahead.
Back to the Second World War, yeah. It's 1941. You're German. Hitler rules the whole of Europe. Nothing's gone wrong for him yet. He's the king of everything. America hasn't joined the war. And even if you're against Hitler, you're petrified of him by now. And suddenly this radio station appears, which is broadcasting these filthy, hilarious orgies of Nazi officials, you know, doing all sorts of things with sailors and ladies of the night, taking over monasteries and dressing up their prostitutes in nuns' outfits and doing all sorts of things with them with spiked helmets and butter. And apart from anything else, it breaks the fear. You know, suddenly you can say these completely uproarious things about Nazi officials who it's the Gestapo, you're petrified of them. So it worked to break the spiral of silence, you know, break the sense that you can't say anything about the Nazis. It worked to make you laugh at them because these are ridiculously detailed sex scenes. You know, these were like, you know, talking in detail about the ugly ghoulies of Nazi officials. You know, you end up laughing at them. At the same time, it's showing that for all their kind of so-called moralism, they're actually deeply corrupt financially and in other ways as well. So I think it helped to get listeners in, you know, reel them in, because everybody in Berlin is suddenly saying, have you heard about this radio show doing porn about, you know, about Goebbels? And it helps you reduce fear. It's got to be said, when the British government found out that Sefton Delmer was creating porn to subvert the Nazis, it caused a scandal, and some of the more religious members of Churchill's cabinet said things like, if this is how we're planning to defeat the Nazis, I'd rather we lose. And they were outraged by it. And Sefton Delmer was almost shut down, even though he had this very big debate about it with his bosses saying, you know, in a war of extermination, I must be allowed to use any tactics, including pornography, for our propaganda aims. And he did win in the end. He wasn't sacked, even though after the scandal, he did tone it down a little bit.
All right, thanks a lot, man. We appreciate you.
Well,
thank
you. I want to tell everybody out there, you got to get this, How to Win an Information War, The Propagandist Who Outwitted Hitler. It's a terrific read. Peter, thank you for being with us. You're a great return guest.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
We'll be right back.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hey, James, now for the outrage of the week. House Republicans are trying to have a field day beating up on Dr. Anthony Fauci. Marjorie Taylor Greene even insisted he wasn't a doctor. Wasn't she the one who also talked about Jewish laser beams? The right-wingers, along with conspiracy-crazed Robert F. Kennedy, say Fauci and company destroyed the American way of life during COVID with shutdowns and restrictions. Look, this was an unanticipated pandemic, a crisis that claimed the lives of 1.2 million Americans. Mistakes were made. That's only natural in this unknown territory. Some schools were closed for too long. There were some unnecessary safeguards. But Dr. Fauci, an incredible public servant in 50 years as the head of NIH's infectious diseases, guided us through this as capably as anyone possibly could. And I mean, when I hear people like James Comer, Congressman James Comer, who's got a room temperature, who's got an IQ of room temperature, say he wants to have Tony Fauci arrested. He doesn't seem to be bothered by all the crimes that Trump has committed. You know, maybe they want to call the COVID examination Donald Trump up. He told early on Bob Woodward he didn't want to level with the American people about the seriousness of COVID, and once suggested maybe we could even use bleach. One call, according to his advisors, this is a Trump advisor, Deborah Birx, said his malfeasance, Trump's malfeasance, cost at least 130,000 lives. Tell me something, you know, Mr. Comer and that Ohio congressman, you want to call Donald Trump in your COVID examination?
Yeah, good point. Very good point. I mean, I thought Dr. Fauci conducted himself with dignity and professionalism, as he always does. And I can't imagine how many lives that guy whose life is saved and how many he would have saved had he been more closely listened to. So I concur in your admiration and affection for him. You know, there are certain columnists and commentators that I pay particular attention to, like Tom Etzel, of course, being one. You know, John Shade a pretty good bit. But one I really pay attention to is Catherine Rampell, right?
Yes.
And I just, the stupidity of the progressives, now they're going after Costco. Now, let's get straight here. Okay, Costco is a big company and they're very successful. It's the most democratic, huge retailer that you can imagine. A single family owns it, or donated all kinds of money to good causes. They were good Democrats. And let me tell you, no one that works at Costco makes anything close to the minimum wage. I know that there's one in New Orleans, and probably the lowest paid hour employee probably makes $16.50 an hour. The people there like it. They're happy. It's cheap. The workforce is very diverse. The customers are, trust me, extremely diverse. There's a lot of families that right at the poverty line, a little bit more, that really save money at Costco. They, you know, got to put some upfront money, but I'm sure they figure a way to deal with that. And of all of the things that's wrong with this country, why are we screwing with Costco, which I think is a admirable corporation? And I love going in there. You got to hide everything, so you got to buy it. I mean, they're marketers. I'm not saying these people are saints or anything like that. But I think that good Democrats should have a very fond opinion of Costco.
So what are the lefties bitching about, James?
It was their size, and you know, it was mostly just a distrust of anything successful. But I can read Catherine's column, and she rises very elegantly and forcefully in defense of Costco. And Ben, Costco is just, wherever they go, they're a fact of life.
And they sure are.
And they're really good.
You know, my kid has moved up to Long Island, Rockville Center, for a congressional race. And, you know, I when he's getting stuff, I say, go to Costco. You got a Costco 4 or 5 miles away. You know, there's no better bargain. There's no better place.
And they got, by the way, their wine selection is top notch. Their prepared foods are all top notch. And, you got to buy a lot. So a guy like me, I'll probably break even. I buy cheaper stuff, but I buy more waste. But if you're a family and you're low, middle, to lower income, Costco is a lifesaver. And those are the exact people that we need to vote for us. And it's just they got to be against something. There's always a people, they got to be just against you. And I don't think Costco.
Yeah.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
All right, now for our listener questions, which we always love, James. So many good ones. Jeffrey in Seattle says, given the recent ethics scandals rocking the Supreme Court and their clear political partisanship, would you favor raising the number of justices from 9 to 13 or 15?
You're not going to it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
All right. So but what could happen is if there's a Democratic Congress and Joe Biden is still the president, if you don't adopt the code of ethics, we're going to cut off funding. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, they got to do something. These people are rogues. They operate outside the law. They don't care. They really don't. By the way, these stories are not going to stop coming. All right? The New York Times, ProPublica, everybody that's been, they're not stopping. And they're going to keep finding stuff. There's no way that they're not going to find stuff. And this is going to go on and on and on.
Next, Patrick in Exeter, Australia, asks, should Hakeem Jeffries call for Mike Johnson to step aside because of Johnson's disrespect towards the jury and the justice system, not to mention his suggestion that his personal friends in the Supreme Court would overturn the decision given the chance? No, that's no point in that. It won't happen. I think the lesson that we've learned, when Johnson did the right thing once on Ukraine, some of the establishment figures were saying, he's really not that bad. Maybe he's better than we thought. No, you're wrong. I'm sorry. I mean, broken clock is right twice a day. He had to do that. There was all kinds of counter pressure. He is Donald Trump's poodle. Whatever Trump wants, Mike Johnson does. If Trump snapped his fingers tomorrow and said, bye-bye, Mike, it would be bye-bye, Mike. He is, I think he's, in fact, a weak speaker. I think he's a man who's got some awfully crazy views, and I think it's going to be hard to hide those. And so basically to your question, Patrick, Hakeem Jeffries shouldn't call for Mike Johnson to step aside. He should call for voters to make Hakeem Jeffries the next speaker.
Yeah, I agree. And it's always fire the coach. Okay, fire the coach. Who's the new coach? Well, it assume for a moment that Hakeem's motion would succeed. Then who do you think the Republicans are going to pick to be their new Speaker of the House? I can tell you, it ain't going to be anything any better. So I'm satisfied that this guy has limited intellectual ability, limited talent, and he has a very small minority, and he's more valuable in there than anybody else.
Yep.
Talking about talking to Supreme Court justices and that kind of stuff, to the extent is more helpful and helpful. So I'm not for getting rid of it.
Yeah.
Plus, he's too much fun to make fun of.
He is fun to make fun of. James, Cam Buckner, who is an Illinois state representative from Chicago, good question. It says, social media's echo chamber effect boosts the view that Biden is tanking the economy. Given the influence of social media, is it now the perception of the economy stupid? What strategy should the Biden campaign adopt to address the disparity between economic indicators and public sentiment?
Well, that's a really good question, and I'm not a big social media person, but I understand how stuff gets trafficked. And like anything else, there's a bias for bad news. And this just is more another log on that fire. I've always thought that this economy is generational. It works pretty well for older people. It doesn't work that well for younger people. And the narrative that's gotten completely fact devoid of what the economy was like under Trump and what the economy is like under Biden. But I don't know if we're going to be able to win that argument between now and Election Day, if that's even the right argument to engage in. I mean, I understand people saying, what are you talking about? And I don't know what an empty seat on an airplane looks like. I just don't. I know it's Manhattan, and I know it's coastal. But literally last night, which was a Tuesday night, I stuck my head in three places, and there wasn't even a seat at the bar. I mean, somebody's spending money out there somewhere, that I can tell you. But people's perception, particularly young people, black people's perception of this economy is not good.
Well, yeah, I agree. And you can't tell people the economy is good when they don't think it is. I mean, that really, they think that's insulting. I think it's counterproductive. I think what you can do is talk about things you can do to ease the pain and make it better. You can talk about, as you've said, raising the minimum wage. You can talk about taxing the rich so you can help people in need. You can talk about some of the corporate ripoffs. And what you have to say basically is, look, I know you got problems. I'm working on it. Here's some things I think we could do. What would the other guy do?
And you can talk about stuff you've done, like capping insulin costs, which affect, I don't know what percent of the people in this country that have diabetes at a percent over 65, but I can tell you what, it's high.
It is.
It's high. And that's very expensive for families. Yes. It's a very provocative question, and there's a lot that goes into this. So let's keep talking about it.
No, I agree. A couple media questions here. Doug in Oceanside, California, wants to know if the press should call him the disgraced ex-president Trump rather than former president. And John in Chicago says, how do you think some of the veteran newscasters like Walter Cronkite and Peter Jennings, to name a few, I would certainly add Tom Brokaw, would have handled these continuous lies coming from the GOP over Trump's conviction? Look, they were good, but I think this is a really hard question for the media. I spent almost 20 years running Washington bureaus covering politics. I'm glad I'm not doing it now. I mean, it's just so difficult. I think I admire the people who do it well. But what do you do when the reaction to the Trump trial this week, you had a whole bunch of supposedly prominent Republicans saying it was all orchestrated by Joe Biden. That is an outright lie. So how do you cover that? And they'll say it today, tomorrow, next week. So I have great respect for Cronkite, Jennings, and Brokaw. They maybe would have done a slightly better job than what we're doing today, but, man, it wouldn't have been easy.
So this is the basic question. But people say, Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, and we got to cover it, and Biden's a Democratic nominee, and we cover this. And if there's something bad about Biden, of course, we got to print it, but if something comes up that is, I don't know if there's anything good about Trump, but more favorable to him, like the L.A. Honigs and the Fareed Zakarias of the world. That's one way to look at it. We tell the truth and let the people decide. Or at times when the country is at great peril or the moral imperative is so great, you don't do that. Let's talk about World War II. And, it's the example I always give. No one did a story saying that Tojo's came from a more humble background than Franklin Roosevelt. Let's talk about the civil rights movement. Okay, there was one side that was correct and the other side was all god-awful wrong, and it was covered that way. And so now you have Joe Kahn, the new editor, publisher, whatever he is, New York Times, said, you know, we're just going to cover this down the middle. We're going to cover what it is. I don't think that's the role of the news media at a time when the entire Constitution is in peril. I don't have anything against slanted coverage. I really don't. I think I would have something against it under most other times in American history, but not right now. Fuck your objectivity. The real objectivity in this country right now is we either going to have a Constitution or we not. And everything else, from Hunter Biden's gun application to Judge Mershon's, I don't know, $35 contribution, to all of the bullshit that the professional center feels like they got to put out. I can't tell you that these are bad people. They're extremely naive people that have no idea of what's at stake here in this election. So I think we need slanted coverage, more slanted coverage, and I think we got to recognize the threat that this guy in the MAGA, not just him, the entire MAGA movement from Alito and Trump on down is a serious, it's a clear, serious, and present danger to the existence of the Constitution of the United States. And I mean that.
James, the only thing I'm going to reject was the term slanted. I think we need fair coverage and not false equivalency. And it was over 70 years ago that one of the greatest journalists in America, Wallace Carroll, later became Reston's deputy in the New York Times Washington Bureau and the publisher of the Winston-Salem Journal, said that it is a mistake for journalism to be imprisoned by objectivity. That was during the McCarthy era. It's even more true today.
Yeah, I guess, you know, slanted. I'll stick with that. But this is not, but on the other hand, coverage.
Yeah.
All right. This one is a, you know, kind of old guy's probably lost a step against a career criminal who would end the Constitution.
Right.
That's not a fight you want to be
right,
down.
Right, or, you know, one of the reasons I so resented what Jamie Dimon said, we'll do, you know, fine under both. I mean, you know, is it the same to have your taxes, your capital gains taxes increase versus ending the rule of law? You know, I don't think it is. Dennis and Melanie in Brisbane, Australia. Hey, James, we're doing pretty well down under today.
Yeah, shit, man. Move down there.
Well, this is for you, though. They said, we recently took a holiday in America visiting Alabama, Louisiana, and Georgia. They say the extraordinary lack of political engagement stunned us, particularly in light of the high stakes. What do you think lies behind this? Fatalism? Or what can be done about it?
Well, I mean, the unfortunately, a lot of the disengagement is among younger voters and black voters.
Yeah.
That's certainly true. I want to address something. That you hear the stuff about the Manhattan jury, all right? New York City, and Manhattan in particular, is a low-crime area. I've checked this out. The crime rate in New York is substantially lower than Florida. And I'm listening to these assholes, most of them from Florida, talking about the Manhattan jury. Well, as I understand, there's not a lack of people in Rikers Island right now. And when you go to that, I was thinking, I spent 40% of my time in Orleans Parish, which is, you're going to, if you get a judge, the judge is going to be a Democrat unless the governor fulfills something. But I also spent 30% of my time in Hancock County. The judge and the jury that I would get if I'm a victim of a crime is going to be overwhelmingly Republican. But you know what? I don't think about that. I'm in Shenandoah County. I'm in Shenandoah County, Virginia. Democrats don't even get 30% in Shenandoah County. But if I get a jury in Shenandoah County, I'm going to trust that jury, and that judge is not going to be a Democrat. I can tell you that. But I got to feel protected wherever I go. And I think the attacks on this jury are downright, you know, there's a specific definition for treason. There's not a legal definition. I think it's borderline treasonous. I really do. To substitute your judgment for people who sat there and listened to everything. And I'm going to say the same thing in Delaware. I'm not following this thing that close. The jury is. Whatever they say is going to have great weight. But we have to stop telling people that there's a two-tiered justice system in this country or any of that kind of stuff. It's by being perfect and flawed, but the most perfect thing about this system we have are juries.
Yeah, and Trump and his lawyers didn't reject any of those 12 jurors. The criticism began after they delivered a unanimous 34-count guilty verdict.
It was all about juror number two.
Right.
And, James, you know what I think of juror number two? Number two.
Laura in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, and this is not a football question or a basketball question, says, how do we support local reporting? The majority of articles I read cite online articles as a source and read like they've been cut and pasted. You know, Laura, that's the real crisis in American journalism. I mean, I hope the Washington Post, which is a great paper, weathers its current problems and some of the other large regional papers. But the real crisis is local journalism. Thousands have died in the last 15 years. And, you know, what you can do about it, there's a couple places. The MacArthur Foundation is trying to raise a lot of money to help them. But I'll tell you the one place, you know, if you want to help, that I would go to is Sarah Beth Berman at the American Journalism Project. They have gone and they are supporting local papers all over the country. One of their great prizes was Mississippi Today, the digital outlet down in Mississippi that has exposed some of the, you know, terrible, terrible malfeasance of office, won a Pulitzer Prize for it. So you're right. Local journalism is in crisis, and do everything you can to support it.
Yeah, to really agree with you, another step, the Mississippi Today is a kind of hybrid model. I think they get some grants and, they get this. But the other places around the country, let me tell you, the Kansas, I think it's the Kansas Reflector, it's the best journalism in Kansas.
Right. Right.
I mean, we think of, you know, the Wichita Eagle or the Kansas City Star, I guess it is, Topeka Journal. They don't have anybody.
Right.
They don't. And you that kind of model doesn't work. The same is true in Tennessee and Kentucky. Like Alabama Today, there's good journalism out there. It's just you got to look for it a little bit. And it generally is not coming out of traditional sources. I mean, you have the Times and the Post, got our national newspapers, but, in the Post was really, still on to some extent, they were very aggressive in Richmond. I mean, they covered Virginia politics. They were really aggressive in Annapolis. They covered Maryland politics, too. But this is the coming thing
in
America.
Well, there's a bunch of those, James. I mean, there's the Texas Tribune, which was the first that started.
Evan Smith is a visionary.
The Min Post in Minneapolis, Minnesota. So there's enough, but there's still a crisis. All of this is going on, you know, and it's good, as good as it is, it's not replacing what we've lost.
No.
It's helping.
No, it's not, but it, I'll tell you what, it's necessary. And if it grows, it might be better.
Right.
I don't know, but they're not covering, you know, the school board in, you know, Shenandoah County, Virginia. There's nothing left for that.
Well, my wife did for the NewsHour, went to Canadian, Texas, small little town that is losing its paper. This was a paper that did a couple, among other things, there was a intersection where four or five, I don't know the exact number of people have been killed over the last 7 or 8 years. And this local paper crusaded to make sure a traffic light was put up there. You know, that's a little thing, but it saved lives. There was no place for elderly sick people to go. They campaigned and they got a senior home in that little town. That's what local papers do, and they hold officials accountable. And boy, the loss is just tremendous. It really is.
It is.
Brandon in San Francisco, you've said Netanyahu is maintaining the war in Gaza to avoid his own possible imprisonment. He says Brandon thinks that's a very serious wag the dog claim against Israel. Why do you think that? Is that the U.S. assessment? And I thought there was a war cabinet that included a cross-section of political spectrum.
Well, I kind of stand by it. I mean, first of all, the negligence of the Netanyahu government was breathtaking. Mm-hmm. I don't know, literally how that government is still there after negligence of this magnitude. And you ought to understand Netanyahu has serious legal problems that are weighing on his head. He has no political interest in ending this. He has, although he might be forced into it, he has no interest in calling an election. And, you know, one of the things, I've been to Israel a lot, and there traditionally have been people that have held governments accountable, and it's time for Netanyahu to be held accountable for the greatest governmental act of negligence since World War II. So, no, I don't think he's a patriot.
Amen. I agree with absolutely everything. Anyway, hey, keep those letters, keep those questions and emails coming in. They are so good. If we didn't get to yours this week, we'll try to get to it next week. Thank you. Hey, thanks for listening to Politics War Room with James Carville, and I'm Al Hunt. Don't forget to send your questions for us by email to politicswarroom@gmail.com or tweet them for next week's show at Politicon. Following this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you check out the links to our sponsors, 3-Day Blinds, Miracle Made, and ExpressVPN in our episode show notes. We thank you for supporting them because when you do, it helps make this podcast happen. Now, to keep up with us, subscribe to Politics War Room on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Now, you also can find other shows you might enjoy in the Politicon YouTube channel or when you search Politicon on your favorite podcast sites. And remember, please rate the show with a 5-star review. We'll be back next week with another show as we continue our War Room planning.
Into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books, and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system, so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.